I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I wanna walk into a cold, bitter ocean, feel the sting of letting go of all hope and so be made of this heartbreak. I wanna drive fast till I break down in nowhere, so I can finally cry these tears when I reach there. I scream, yeah, I'll let it all.
Read you an email. Mac, I love when you dig that stuff up. Where did you find it? Because most of that didn't make the news. Yeah, you know, if you pay attention, and it's a bit of an art, but, you know, that was buried in the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. And, what did you hear? You heard him talk about Iran, mental health, our nuclear posture, the Arctic, right? Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, right? And so you heard him go around the wheel. But, and again, when you watch this stuff and then you see what comes through the news channel, right? Knowing that, you know, some reporter writes that and he's got between 300 and 600 words to articulate, you know, something that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff lays out, right? And given his own bias, given his own problems communicating, then you get what you get. And it's not always accurate because the problems tend to be a little bit more complex than they come through in your basic story. And then some shithead headline writer looks at the story and says, okay, how do I get people to click on this? What's the sexiest piece of this thing so that I can keep it above the fold and everybody will love my work? So anyway. And so whenever you can hear him in long format in their own words, right? And I'll tell you what, he and Mattis together, Shanahan not so much because he just doesn't have the experience, but when you used to hear he and Secretary Mattis together articulating the complexities of a problem and how we're trying to get our hands around it and the implications for it, to me, that was the best. It was the best. Joining me today, without the Kenny part of the Lynch-Kenny combination, Jeff Kenny. What's up, man?
How are you, Mac? I'm doing good myself. Thank you.
I'm all right. I just played a bunch of comments from the chairman relative to different issues around the country, and then you read a story about it. But you've had that experience where you've lived on the ground in Afghanistan, and then you see some schmo write about it, and it's like the issue is so much more complex than that, right?
Right.
But this is the truth for the American people. A tad frustrating, eh?
Oh yeah, I was in Liberia in '96 when I was switching in and out with another rifle company commanded by Eric Mellinger, and one of our out times, we're out for 8 days at a time. They flew me over to the Guam, and I got interviewed by John McQuethy.
Oh
and
yeah.
So I told him exactly what had happened. You know, the last time I was in there, it was pretty fairly straightforward. But when I read his article, it was like, who the hell was he talking to? You know. Now, on the other hand, here I am, 10 years later, I'm an advisor, almost exactly 10 years later, I'm an advisor to the Iraqi Army, 2nd Brigade of the 7th Division there in the western part of Anbar Province along the Euphrates, and I had for a couple days with me, I had Greg Gutfeld, or not Greg, I'm sorry, Rick Leventhal, and a producer, female producer named Callista something, who I've seen do her own things later on through the years, and a cameraman. And they stayed with us for 3 days, and they got it. And the main thing he was interviewing me about was the complexity about getting the Iraqis their pay and getting their pay back home, because there was no reliable mail and there was no there's no wire type service that could help them. It had to be done physically, and so it was a difficulty. It necessitated 1/3 of the Iraqi brigade being on leave at any one time. So that is, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I couldn't believe it, but we had to deal with that. And also other complexities. But I'll tell you, Leventhal really got it across, you know? And we were in some kind of tense situations a couple times, and he was able to do it. But then, I've been with others where I was in like for instance, a KLE with the brigade commander of the brigade that controlled the Kunar Lagaman, Nuristan part of, eastern Afghanistan.
All right, tell everybody what KLE is.
It's a key leader engagement with Afghan leaders. In this case, Afghan army leaders, Afghan police leaders, and Afghan tribal leaders of that area. And there are two guys there. One of them was dead on, balls accurate in his reporting, and the other one was, you know, tied up with minutia, and that, you know, it was inaccurate. So it's very, and then there's nothing that holds people accountable when they step on when they make mistakes like that. You know,
they'll just write another story.
Right.
No, right. It's frustrating. And again, and then the American people, that's the truth. You know, this guy's in Iraq reporting, so that's the truth. And so it's frustrating when the truth doesn't get told, or the truth doesn't matter, or it winds up on the cutting room floor because it's just not sexy enough. And so, you know, I used to see that. And then you, conversely, as Jeff's talking about, the people that do it right, their stock goes way up. There's a guy named Michael Gordon that wrote for I think he still writes for the New York Times. That, I mean, to me, I read his stuff when I was in Iraq, and I was like, I don't know that dude, but he tells the truth.
Right.
He can tell the truth. So, and then the other interesting part is, how the hell do the American people have an informed discussion if they don't even know the truth? And when I would come home and resume doing my radio show, you know, people are so confused, right? Well, I see one thing, and then I swear to God, if I keep the news on, 10 minutes later, somebody completely contradicts that. So what's the truth?
Right.
And that was a cool part of being able to have, you know, our friends on from those places and say, hey, they're there. Ask them. And they'd call up and say, do they want us there? And they'd get the answer, the truth. They absolutely want us here, but they can't say that, or else somebody would pump a bullet in their head, or the head of their kids or their wife or somebody, and you know, nobody wants that. So so it's interesting, the media. I sent you a little bit ago kind of a blast from the past. One of the interesting things about the series that we're going to do here on All Marine Radio, about this discussion about leadership, is General Ben Riper is going to, you're going to hear an interview that I'll record with him this afternoon. You'll hear that on Monday. And I'm just going to tee him up, and I'm not sure where it's going to go, but General Van Riper, when we were captains, lieutenants, he was the CG of the 2nd Marine Division, and he was legendary about his devotion to discipline. And Jeff and I were talking a little bit earlier, similar, kind of along a parallel track, but not really. I got interested in the DMZ battles of 1967, 1968 in the northern part of I Corps in Vietnam after I interviewed Butch Neal about a fight at what's called the Battle of Gitlin's Corner. And that is where Lieutenant Bobo earns his Medal of Honor. That is where the decorations list is a Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, 6 Silver Stars, and 3 Bronze Stars in a 5.5 hour fight.
Okay. Right.
So I got interested in that. And so I'm reading about Operation, the Prairie series of operations, right? I can't remember which one of them, but you know, they killed something like, you know, 200 Marines die, and they kill like 1,342 NVA regular soldiers. And, you know, the artillery that they got shot at with and all the different things. And then, so you read that and you're like, holy shit, man. it was on, and then you start reading about Comtien and, you know, the dominant piece of terrain that it was, but it was a shit magnet from artillery in caves north of the DMZ that we couldn't hit, and those guys just got a very much like Quezon. The numbers don't sound as bad, but
it was like rehearsal for Quezon.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so I started reading about that, and I was like, "Holy shit!" And in retrospect, this was the last time that we fought what you could say a near peer in the Army of North Vietnam that would locate, close with, and come and get your ass in sustained combat operations. And so, to me, it's pretty interesting. These guys, that was their time as lieutenants and captains. General Van Riper, General Zinni, General Smith, Colonel Ripley, all those guys, their experience was then, right? And so General Van Riper, when he became the CG of the 2nd Marine Division, man, he dropped the shit hammer of the gods on everybody. And yeah. I didn't really understand it. I mean, I didn't understand it like I understood it when I went back to Iraq in 2004. But Jeff was around. You were in the 2nd Division, yes, then?
Yeah. It was to the point where it was hard to tell after a while what was his and what was people doing what they thought was his intent. Like, for instance, I remember we had one where we had a regulation come out saying that all the blinds and the windows in the battalion headquarters, and you were just at Lejeune, Mac. You've been there a couple times. Right. Now how that thing is set up, it's exactly the same. Had to be at the same level, like when they were open and when they were shut. In other words, you couldn't have like one window that had the blinds all the way up and another one that had them all the way down, you know? Most of it was just good order and discipline stuff. You know, your uniforms, your boots, running PT in formation, right? If you're in a common area and you weren't doing like wind sprints or something, if you're just running down, he didn't like seeing five or six guys just running jaw-jacking. You know, if there's more than three guys, you better be in formation. General Van Riper in command. Now, I have to tell you, like I said, I met the guy later. I'm like when I transferred up to where I met you, and the first time I met him, I was still a first lieutenant. I was in charge of the weapons room for EI Company, and the first thing I had to do was put out a stack display for his guys from India 3-7. I think it was India 3-7, and who were there for like a reunion. And he was wearing a golf shirt and slacks, and none of that was manifested. And he talked to all my guys, and I'm like, I hope these son of a bitches all shaved. I didn't have a chance to check them.
The first time I ever crossed paths with, listen to this, I was teaching in the defense at the basic school, probably a little bit before you got there. And so they just finished an attack, and so... the offensive guys kind of hand them off to me. Now we're going to put in the, you know, a platoon defense. And so there was supposed to be somebody with me, but something happened with his wife or something, and he wasn't going to be there, and they were going to send somebody else out. But when you have one, right, captain with with whatever, 50 lieutenants, and you're trying to set this thing in and make sure, I mean, it's a lot of work, right? Because there's, right. So anyway, my radio crackles. And, Oscar Three Mike, this is whoever it was. Oscar Three Mike would be me, a captain by the name of McNamara, right? And so anyway, I'm like, Roger, what's up? Durham Van Riper is en route to your pause right now. I said, what? And they're like, yep, just want to give you a heads up. Like, Roger, yeah. Roger out. And so now the Jeep,
See, that was Kennedy on the other end of the line. He would have said, he's mad.
I know. He's mad. He's looking for you. So yeah. So where he's going to get out of the Humvee is like on the far, on one end and I of the platoon. And because we're tying into supposedly we had the road inclusive, right? Or something. But I'm at the far end. So I come walking back and he meets me like about a third of the way. And I salute and I'd never met him in person. I'd only heard of him. Nice. And we shake hands and he says, Mac, tell me what's going on. I said, well, sir, they just got done with an attack. They've been up all night, and now we're going to set in the deed. And so he started, he looks at me and he says, is this kind of the normal state that you'd find lieutenants in after, you know, shit everywhere? And I said, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And he said, all right. He said, can I help? I said, yes, sir. You know, Lieutenant Kenny was supposed to be out here with me, and right, and he's got some kind of family emergency, so it's just me.
He was drunk.
He said, what do you need me to do? I said, well, sir, we're, you know, like every platoon, we're site and crew serve weapons, so everybody can start digging. He said, all right. He said, so back, I head back to this way and help that machine gun team. I said, yes, sir. I said, I'll meet you in the middle. He said, all right. So that was my first, and I was like trying to keep like all my sphincter muscles shut because of the legend that General Van Riper was.
Yeah.
And so he's going to come on. But so listen to this. Here's an email I got early this morning. Mac, as you prepare for the upcoming All Marine Radio episodes on discipline and leadership, I thought the attachments might come in handy, especially if you are able to book Lieutenant General Van Riper. I've been carting these memos around for almost 30 years, referring to them periodically, because the guidance, example, and advice contained therein is sage and timeless. I hope they are useful and interesting to you. I might add, they're also well written too. As CO of Company B, 2nd LAI Battalion, from October of 90 through April of 92, during that time, I fortunately served under two exceptional battalion commanders, Brigadier General Keith Holcomb and Colonel Jim Leonard. Holcomb, in particular, was probably the finest and most professional officer with whom I ever served. He continues to influence me to this day. Brigadier General Holcomb, Lieutenant General Van Riper were certainly cut from the same cloth and, for that reason, had a close friendship. You should ask General Van Riper about him when he's on the air with you. I remember quite well serving under Lieutenant General Van Riper in the division during that time, and in light of Dave Furness's challenges, there are no doubt some parallels, which I think are obvious from the 21 rules memo in particular. Let me close by saying how much I enjoy your podcast. Keep it up. I particularly look forward to the Lynch Kenny Hour. Jeff and I were AWS classmates in 94, 95 and deployed together to the Med and Liberia in 96 with the 22nd MU. He was a company commander in the BLT. I was a MU S3 Alpha. I had a lot of respect for Jeff back then, especially for his practical and common sense approach to the trade, particularly training. So,
I appreciate that.
Do you know Bill Harrop?
Yeah.
But no, these things like fall out of the sky to me.
Yeah.
And it's just the coolest stuff. It's just the coolest stuff in the world. He goes on to close with, I enjoy hearing the same approach reflected in his All Marine Radio commentary. While I don't know Tim or you as a matter of fact, except via LinkedIn, I know of him and we all had a ton of mutual friends. I think Tim left recruiting duty about the time I took over as the CO of RS Indianapolis. I did my RSCO right seat ride with Dave Furness when he was at Sacramento. Served with General Alford as well, drank beers with all of them, Semper Fi. So these things are so cool. And I'll tell you what, that's probably the fifth email I've gotten, people excited to hear these officers. And if you haven't heard, General Van Riper's going to come on, General Mattis will come on, General Bedard will come on, and General Halick will come on. And that's just the start of the list. I'm hopeful that the Burning Bush himself, General Zinni, will come on. I'm going to bait him today saying, hey, sir, the rest of these jabronis are coming on. this conversation is not going to be complete without the Burning Bush. I got an email.
Scared of him.
Yeah, I got it. Here's another email I get last night. And this shows up at like, let's see, 11, so 23:12 last night. I was doing some tax stuff. And I was getting ready to go to bed. All of a sudden, I see this. This is from a guy named Jerry M. And it's posted to the Combat Concepts video that is up on YouTube that I put up there. All right?
All
right. Which is, if you haven't seen it, watch it. It's General Zinni being what every Marine officer should be. He writes this. Thanks for sharing. Been listening to All Marine Radio for the last 4 months. Wish I found this and All Marine Radio 2 years ago before my company Command Time. Invaluable resources for us to continue to learn, think, teach, and coach. Just started this 4-part series, but it would have been good to add to our discussions at the battalion company level in the Maneuver Warfare Handbook and MCDP.
Maneuver Warfare Handbook.
And,
Bill Lind.
Yeah, MCDP1, Semper Fidelis. So these things, if you can't tell how much I enjoy doing this, but the excitement to hear these guys talk about discipline, right, in light of their long experiences, both in combat and in peacetime, has whetted the appetite of many people for this, which to me is pretty cool.
I have to tell you, too, Mac, that Harrop guy, he was pretty sharp. He wrote an article, which I think is in the Gazette, while we were in AWS, about the challenges of being a company grade officer with the burgeoning of the ability for you know, distant command posts to monitor your activities on a second-by-second basis. And that was the dawn of, like, the Blue Force Tracker. You know, the idea
right.
They could track movements of units. And so he wrote, it was an interesting article. We actually had, he fictionalized it and then he commented on it. So it was good. But, that's the thing about this is that, you run into these folks who, their experiences, you know, color their stuff. And when you start talking about your experience, even though they're different, I'm a leg infantry guy and like you, Harrop is he's a LAI at that time, LAI guy. So,
right.
But the idea of the high speed, command and control, covers both types. So yeah, it was stimulating. For
well,
sure.
And then, again, I saw this firsthand in Afghanistan. It was really interesting for me having taught maneuver warfare or wrestled. And when Jeff and I were there, we were wrestling with maneuver warfare because you had guys like Bill Lynn acting like they knew what it was. And we were trying to teach it and saying, like, well, how can it work like that, right?
Yeah.
Right? Lynn's like, he throws it all over the room. Deception, initiative, like, we're just going to throw it out there. Everybody's going to kind of do their own thing. Then it all works magically together. And,
yeah.
you're thinking, okay, the Germans still had to refuel, right? They had all those fucking tanks.
Absolutely.
Right? How did they?
Bill Lynn never talked about that shit.
Right? How did they do all this shit? How did they know where people would be? Like, if everybody was, like, off on their own program. And he just waves a wand at it and he waves it away. So Jeff and I are both there when we're wrestling with these things. And we were really fortunate because the guys we were there with have turned out to be, by their proven record, very, very smart people. Right, but we're just punk ass, lieutenants and captains who are talking shit and doing research, and then mostly fueled by the desire to jam it up somebody else's ass in public, and then say yeah, blah. And so we come there, we get there with these experiences at this kind of thing the Marine Corps is doing, and yet we're trying to figure it out, and so it was an awesome experience, and then you bump into people like Zinni and Van Riper. And so Van Riper, to me, I was like, this guy and all his chicken shit, blah, 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 blah. I don't know that I'll say that to him, but, cause he still kind of scares me. But
yeah.
Zinni stands up in that PME, and this is why you should watch it. And he does nothing but rip on Van Riper, who's a brigadier general. Zinni's a colonel. And Bill Lynn the whole night. I mean, he does it kind of respectfully, but he jabs him the whole night and he says this hilarious thing. He said, we had warriors night. He's talking about the PME he did with in the 9th Marine Regiment. And he said, and I taught every one of them. And he said, we had the chaplain do it, but one night we called it warriors night and we had these three guys there, right? One they called the Prussian, right? And the other one they called the surfer and the other one they called the philosopher. And then, he said, I'm not going to mention any names. And then he turns and he looks at Van Riper, right? And he says, don't wax your board, General. And, right? And everybody falls out laughing. But Zinni could do this like nobody. Funny, smart, tough combat experiences. And so when they said shit, you had to listen because they were buddies. And then it made you scratch your head like, okay, if Zinni's buddy with Van Riper, that means he respects Van Riper. That means Van Riper can't be the ass clown that I think he is. That means I don't understand something that Zinni does because Zinni's good with him. What is that? And that's always a good proposition, that when you don't understand something, right, it's on you, not on them. And but it's interesting how low all these years later, you know, the interest in the subject, and I think it's going to be this reservoir of discussions on discipline are going to be so cool for a young leader to go and listen to and hear it from guys who fought with somebody who would fucking close with your ass, who would shoot artillery, mortars, bring Bangalore torpedoes and flamethrowers and come fucking get your head on a stick.
Yep.
Right? That's what, yep. I mean, and so that's who these guys fought. And so what were the lessons that they learned? And so I know it's hard to tell, but I'm fired up about it.
But you know, it's like those guys were, that NVA threat that was in those years from 67 to 69, they shaped a large part of the Marine Corps. They shaped Colonel Turley, because Turley was the head advisor who stood in the door in 1972. He was in charge of Smith and Ripley and Livingston, all those guys, when the NVA came at the South Vietnamese exactly the way you just described, with the addition of tanks and a little bit of air. So, and here they are trying to face that. And so when Turley left there, he's the guy who invented what we call CACs out there at 29 Palms. And it was based on the necessity to be able to take what support you had and make it effective. And that's what drove the whole idea about, like, the FIST team and all this stuff. It was Colonel Turley, Jerry Turley. And, but you're right. I mean, and those guys were shaped by that thing. That's a, because they learned, we all have the lesson, discipline is important because, and most of us never learn the reason why, because we don't get into the situation. Most people who join the Marine Corps, thank God, never see combat. And if they do, it isn't to the level that those guys saw up there in the DMZ area of the northern part of South Vietnam. And so consequently, they don't have the denouement, whatever, of the sentence. We don't have the finish of it where, or this will happen. And when it happens, it's horrible. And you better have your shit together. whether it's a correct fighting hole, or having good comm, or remembering to make that a priority target you got in that gully that kind of inflates your defensive position, all that stuff. You know, there's a reason why it's important to remember to make sure your belt's the right length and, you know, your edge dressing's on, when we used to have to worry about that stuff.
Right.
Because it does relate to real things.
Well, you know, and then you hear stories. I heard the one I heard the other day, in talking about Contien, was a corporal that said, looked at his 19-year-old corporal in Vietnam. 19 years old. Okay, 19-year-olds aren't corporals, okay?
Right.
But they were then, because the force was so young in a lot of places. And, you know, he looks at his Marines, he says, hey, look, I don't know what's going to happen tonight, but all I want you to know is I've never been more proud to serve with anybody as I am with you. And then he goes out and he's killed within the hour of saying that, because they were of the hand-to-hand fighting. There's a book out there that Colonel Turley wrote, right? It's called The Easter Offensive.
Right.
The Last American Advisors, Vietnam, 1972. You can get it on Amazon.com. The hardcover for $4.99. Paperback, which I assume is newer. You can get a new hardcover for $36.36. There's five of them available right now, and a new version of the paperback is $18. But again, if you want to see a lesson of strategic individuals, right?
Yeah.
The NVA with every tank they had in the world coming down Highway 1, and Jerry Turley, right? Captain Livingston, Captain Ripley, right, and Captain Smith, those guys, I mean, they changed the history of that fight. Those guys did. And it's just amazing. The
that's such an interesting thing. The those fights at Con Tien and outside of Jiaolin and over there, you know, at Khe Sanh, the NVA were able to master the art of indirect fire from the reverse slope of the surrounding terrain. And I remember Colonel Smith giving us a PME on indirect fire, you know, in Vietnam. And what it was is these guys would have, they would have the pits dug for like a 120 mortar, and everything's in there, including the base plate, but they move the tube around in six or seven different positions. You never see the signature of the thing. It's on the reverse slope. And they shoot it, and it's very accurate. They'll shoot it when they have the big guns shooting from across the border in North Vietnam, which gain all the attention, which that's what the bombers are going after and so forth. They're very detailed in it. And what that necessitated was the artillery at Khe Sanh was mostly 105s.
Okay.
But surrounding Khe Sanh, they had the most complex defensive fires, up one draw and down another one. And the complexity of the groups in series, what that is, five or six targets put together, so that when you have to call it, you just say fire apples. If it's and all these guys got to do is pull a lanyard, and six rounds are coming down on that area, which is devastating. It's a 105.
So a series is a series of targets,
right?
I should say this: a group, right, is a series is multiple targets in a group. Right?
Right.
A series is multiple groups, right?
Groups, right.
And so when you talk about that, and so when you hear guys like General Smith get down in the weeds, and you know what, for guys like us, it seemed like they were reluctant to do it, right? You had to get them in very specific situations to get them to talk about the specifics of what they fought. Zinni talks about, when he was an advisor, right, he was an advisor to the South Vietnamese Marines, and he said they tie into a bunker complex. And he said, but it wasn't like what school's demonstration troops did, which was the forerunner of EI Company, at the basic school. There wasn't a flank conveniently dangling off that we could get around. Right? The Vietnamese, he said, did everything in some kind of depth. So the position wasn't a line, it was an X, right?
Right.
And the
or
X
C, or
right.
A Yankee.
Right. So it was just things with multiple sides. So you hit it from the front, you get fire from two sides. You go to envelop it, like they taught me in Quantico, and you still got fired from two sides. So how the hell did I do this? And then, so you sit there and you have conversations about that kind of stuff with your friends, and you hear that and you're like, so what do we do? Well, how do we create a flank? And then somebody says, well, maybe we blast the flank into it.
Right.
Like, oh, shit. So you don't try to turn it, right? You try to crush it, and then in that way you create the hole, and that's the flank that you exploit. Oh, shit. And
you
these guys had such incredible knowledge of fighting and a formidable foe who didn't just play the ROE game with you, right, and put out IDs. These guys would close with you. And think about the genius behind, right? Think about the genius behind, right? Multiple mortar positions, the base plate's already sunk, right? So that means the mortar's gonna be extremely accurate round one, right? And you're gonna use the masking of heavy artillery that's north of the DMZ that wheels back into caves so the Americans can't touch it, right? You're gonna use that, right, as masking for your weapons.
Right.
It's genius. I mean, and how did they just grow up learning how to do that? No. How did anything on the forward slope got annihilated? All right. So we got to move to the reverse slope. And then they'll even find us there. Okay. What if we have multiple positions? Okay. So, I mean, you can see the evolution on the NVA, which is simply we want to live to go eat dinner tonight. And the Americans have firepower from hell. But anyway, go ahead. I was interrupting you.
No, that's true. Tim's dad does a good like informal treatise on the whole thing about what the Marines and the Army up there called the trace, and that was the real manifestation of McNamara's operational plan, the McNamara line, which is really nothing more than Hadrian's Wall in northern England, you know, to keep out the Scots.
Right.
And it was, but the idea was it would be denuded area, you know, that was like a couple of maybe a click at the most wide. Denuded of all vegetation, with strong points, sensors, mines, QRF forces and everything that could respond. And that's what necessitated all those brutal fights, because the NVA weren't going to let that happen. And that's how you got Cong Tien, that's how you got Jio Lin, that's how you got Kaesan, and some of those other places up there.
Yeah, that's all that, it's what the Marines called Leatherneck Square.
Yes.
Up there with Dong Ha in the lower right corner, and you go upper right is Jio Lin, and upper left is Cong Tien. Lower left is Camp Carroll or
right.
Cam Lo.
Yeah, well, there's American names, but I think you're right. Cam Lo is
the lower left-hand corner. When we think of Vietnam, right, Cong Tien is not one of the top, right,
no.
battles. But when you read about it, you read the narrative of it, where did The Walking Dead get the nickname The Walking Dead?
Yeah, on the trace. Operation Buffalo, right?
Right. To me, fascinating. And then you link that to the hard lessons that guys like General Van Riper, in his time in Vietnam, guys like General Zinni, guys like Colonel Turley, guys like Colonel Ripley, and these guys were hard asses for this shit too.
Yeah.
Right? They would give you, like, Colonel Smith gives you this, like, southern boy, good old dude.
Right.
Yeah. Cross swords with that guy and see what happens with you. Your head's going to be on the floor and you won't even know it because he's going to do it with that southern drawl.
Real Lejeune, it's the haircut time once a week. I'm coming in the barber shop, and who's walking in there in front of me? Ray Smith.
Uh-oh.
And this fucking major, he runs and jumps in front of Colonel Smith. I couldn't believe the guy.
What?
Anyway, he gets in the chair. There's a couple of barbers there, but he gets in the chair ahead of Colonel Smith, and he's holding forth to the barber. And the barber's, talking to him and stuff, and the guy goes, gets to the point where Colonel Smith's right behind, he's in the other chair with the other barber, and the guy says, "Hey, Jim, don't put any of that smelly, perfumey stuff on me. I don't want my wife to think I was in a French whorehouse." And Colonel Smith, like a minute later, says, "Hey, Pete," and to his barber, "go ahead and put that shit on me. My wife doesn't know what a French whorehouse smells like."
they were hilarious guys. I heard Smithler is fluent in Vietnamese.
Yes, he is. So is Colonel Ripley. Yeah, he was, anyway.
That's not, just for everybody who knows about language learning, it doesn't make any sense in your brain, like a Romance language does.
Right.
Right? There's no link.
Not Latin or Greek-based.
Yeah, it's not. It's for you to learn. It's like learning Russian.
Right.
What? Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very cool stuff. Mac, you're raving about these 21 rules. I remember hearing about it, but could you give us some examples of it? Yeah. Hold on. Let me pull up the, all right, now this is, again, General Van Riper, famous for this, right? And then General Mattis had his flat-ass rules, right?
Yeah, I think they're like, General Mattis is like the son of General Van Riper, the successor, what I mean?
Right, but I mean these, and they make no qualms about it. Rule number one, only the Marine sailor who owns a weapon will draw, clean, and return it to the armory. This includes everyone from division commander to the most junior private. Two, living spaces will be inspected every day. A general schedule will have regimental commanders inspecting semi-annually, battalion commanders quarterly, company commanders monthly, platoon commanders every week or two, platoon sergeant squad leaders daily.
Every day.
Yeah. Right? And then you hear that story we told about the commandant goes into a duty hut. And there's cobwebs hanging from the ceiling. The duty doesn't stand up. And then they go look at a room, and there's a fucking four-wheel drive tire in it. And the commandant says to the Marine, this is the story that was related to me, "Hey, what is that?" "That's a tire, sir." "I know that. What is it doing in here?" "I don't know, sir. It's been here since I got here." "How long have you been here?" 5 months. Right.
That tire's at 8th and I right now in the general's house.
The shit like that. Number three, appropriate noontime activities consist of PT, chow, professional reading, working on MCI courses, haircuts, PX runs, etc. Inappropriate are playing cards, working on personal automobiles, reading novels. Number four, uniform means uniform. No formation should have Marines in different uniforms without a specific reason. Individuals do not choose what to wear or what to carry. Unit leaders do. Bad examples are formation in which part of the Marines wear field jackets or raincoats and the rest do not, or formations in which Marines are allowed to carry or wear helmets at their option.
Right.
Now, this is, okay, this is the one that, right, that people would go crazy for. Standing lights left on or trash in the vicinity of buildings will cause occupants to receive an immediate free inspection from the division commander. The inspection will be conducted regardless of other ongoing activities or time of day and will include personnel, wall walkers, all spaces, and grounds.
And there's no way to escape. Like, the first thing a good corporal will do is say, let's just break these fucking standing lights so they don't take the light bulbs out. Fuck no. If they're not on, he's going to inspect at night. There's no way out of this. We got to do the right thing here in regards to standing lights.
Oh, my God. Number six, obscene or profane language will not be tolerated.
Uh-oh.
I know. I'm in trouble on that one. Hey, where's my General Van Riper tracker? Number seven, soft drinks, ice cream cones, sandwiches, etc. will not be consumed by Marines or sailors walking along the street. Eat or drink items where purchased or take them to an appropriate place such as barracks, picnic areas, or workspaces. Obviously, smoking or chewing gum will not be tolerated when walking along the street. Obviously.
Right.
So this is his 21 rules. Being a Marine, and I saw earlier he wrote that, hey, what's important is that Marines understand, right? Being a Marine isn't a job. It's something different. It's something special. And we need to treat it as such, and we need to expect behavior like that.
Right. That's right. And, that's something that's hard to understand, too, is like, you know, if you're going to be off duty, then you're off duty. You know, but if you're on duty, you're on duty. And General Van Riper's thing is, you know, we do these things because it's not like working at the Five and Dime or something. It's, you know, right. It's your identity now while you're in and probably forever.
Here's number nine. Every Marine or sailor who departs a unit will be seen and thanked personally for his or her service if such has been honorable. Honorable discharges will be presented in front of a unit formation. So it's not just all, you know, what your lines are, all right? Number 12, the quality and quantity of food our Marines receive is important to all of us. Thus, commanders should routinely eat at least one meal each week in their unit's mess hall, inspecting the facility at the same time.
Yep. Yeah, it's good chow, too, nowadays.
I know. Sunglasses in formation without a medical requirement, sleeveless skivvy shirts, utility covers under helmets, personal sheathed knives or other weapons, riding on 782 gear, or Rambo headbands are not authorized. Every Marine will be issued a bayonet or a K-bar as appropriate and carry the same when armed in the field. This is not to be an issue from the box, but assignment by local serial number of a particular weapon.
Wow.
Listen to this.
Yeah.
No, number 17, beware the good worker syndrome. The Corps is only interested in men and women who are good Marines 24 hours a day, every day of the year. Good Marines are promoted and reenlisted. Good workers are separated from the Corps at the earliest opportunity. Right? Good worker only done during working hours.
Yep.
Let's see. Keep Marines in TO billets that match their MOS. Train them to individual training standards or the standards set forth in the Marine Corps Combat Readiness Evaluation System. And then number 21, failure to obey base traffic regulations, particularly deliberate acts such as driving while on suspension or driving under the influence of alcohol, are violations of lawful orders and will be treated as such. There you have it. Paul K. Van Riper. So those went around the Marine Corps, but again, what was he trying to instill? The discipline that he learned was so significant to our lives when somebody's willing to close with us.
You know, in a way, it's kind of like post-traumatic winning, because basically what he's making people do is pay attention to each other. I mean, everybody is you have an order from the division commander to pay attention to your subordinates. And you know, the more subordinates you have, the more broad your responsibilities are. But it gets down to every day that squad leader and platoon sergeant are looking at those guys. And while you're looking at them, you're talking to them. You know, and then all the way up the line. It's the thing is that we're in this together. You know, and even though you may be a corporal now and the sergeant's looking at you once a week, you know, the best way to stay out of his shit list is to make sure those lance corporals under you are good to go. And the best way to make them good to go is to be good to go yourself. And so that's the whole idea behind the inspection thing. It's a hard thing to realize, even though they tell you that from the get-go. I mean, it was on my second enlistment. I didn't just think it was anything more than a pain in the ass. Because right. I was one of those 19-year-old corporals. I mean, I was a corporal, you know, I turned 19 in August, and on November 1st that year, 1976, I made corporal.
Wow.
Not because I was that good. It wasn't meritorious. It was because everybody got out in those days. I mean, shitloads of people got out. And so, consequently, you were going to be a sergeant, you know, in most MOSs, by the time, you know, you got to your 3.5-year mark. So, yeah.
What, I had something brilliant I was going to say, Tim. No, I've got an email here. Mac, really interesting to hear his emphasis on inspections. Do you still think that is the case? I don't know. My instinct would be to say no. But to me, it's just what you do. You know, I learned it, you know, and again, that one little phrase, expect what you inspect.
Yeah, it's true.
It's 1,000% true. I have a saying, if it was only 100% true, I wouldn't bother you with it, but it's 1,000% true. It's like drinking with PTSD or trauma in your life. You want to fuck your life up? There's the blueprint right there, because you become a raving maniac. Okay, so have at it. But relative to performance, if you inspect your Marines, if you inspect their rooms, if you inspect the vehicles, if you inspect the rifle, they'll do the work. And if you're smart enough to link it to early Libo, it'll get done like you can't even believe.
Yeah.
So it is. Truism of all truisms. In fact, I was with my oldest son briefly, who's headed to Fort Benning to go to MCCC before he heads out to be a company commander. And I said, hey man, if I only give you one piece of advice, first of all, you know, you'll thank God that you came here to the basic school and learned your job and then learned how to train and then also got a chance to be, you know, a bit of a company commander, you know, here at the basic school. And I said, but the one thing I'll tell you is inspect. Just inspect your guys. And if you inspect them, they'll do whatever you want. It's not hard, but you got to have the infrastructure there with the predictability and a standard that they understand, and they'll give that to you. And then on your part, you'll be confident that you can go where you're supposed to go, do what you're supposed to do, because they meet that standard all the time. And he looked at me and said, got it. I'm like, all right, we'll see. Another email. I'm sitting here laughing, listening to this stuff. It brings back some nightmarish days in the 2nd Marine Division. I did listen to that Zinni thing. One of the funniest things he said to me was that there would be regimental commanders out throwing trash in each other's areas so they could get somebody else yoked up to take the pressure off themselves. I thought that was straight up hilarious.
Yeah, it was like, be true to your area, man. Got to beat out 2nd Marines, you're an 8th Marines, and 6th Marines on the other side of the main drag, so fucking watch out for them.
You know, and the key to that is the duties got to get out of the hooch, and they got to walk around. And look, they've got people at their disposal to go clean stuff up, and that's what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be out and about checking things out, right? And stop number one ought to be at or near the dumpsters, right, where people clean out their cars and throw shit all over the place. And it's just, you know, it's just business. It's just business. It's making the business work. And again, what's he doing? He's out inspecting. And that's how this shit begins to roll downstream.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you, I played General Dunford a little bit ago. He and the Secretary of Defense, acting type, Shanahan, testified in front of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Subcommittee on Defense yesterday. Pretty interesting stuff. He's talked about everything from Iran and what's gone on over the weekend.
Which
he spoke in detail of that, and it still hasn't got out. And so here's what he said. What he said was, hey, we saw indications of them moving assets, didn't name them, and we communicated that to them. We also, I advised the secretary that I had given orders to the Lincoln that was headed into the Persian Gulf anyway. Because you don't just get from Norfolk to the Persian Gulf like on accident, like, all right, let's go, boys. It doesn't happen like that. So he said, I said that they should get there with utmost speed, and which nuclear aircraft carriers can do. And I also expedited the deployment of the B-52s so that there would be no mistake in terms of our readiness should anything happen there. So I want to get your thoughts on Iran, and that must be a significant movement of supposedly ballistic missiles, either offshore or into Iraq, pray tell, to have the United States make a response like that.
The Americans that we have, Army and the few Marines that are in there, are in highly vulnerable positions because they're not in combat formations conventional combat formations. They're there assisting the Iraqi Army and in some cases the police. And also there's a large contingent of NATO folks there doing the same thing. So it's basically a raid to help the Iraqis deal with ISIS right now. So they're highly vulnerable, particularly to Iranians. Now, there's Iranians in Iraq. There's Iranians who are outwardly no kidding Iranians. They're there helping because they also have a vested interest to oppose ISIS, even though ISIS is very negligent now in Iraq, relatively speaking. But they also they're also there like in a they're in militia groups. Now everyone knows that the majority of Iraqis are Shia. They're the sect of Islam that believes is Shia, as is Iran.
Right.
A large minority though are Sunni. For instance, the place where the Marines were in Anbar, exclusively Sunni, and because of that, you know, there's that tension. Now your natural fear is that the Iraqi Shia would naturally ally with the Iranian Shia because, you know, they have that in common. However, my experience is, and what I'm hearing, you know, now is that the Iraqi Shia are not necessarily enamored of the Iranian Shia. They don't really like the Iranians that much. However, I think what this move is saying is if you mess around in Iraq, we will hit you in a different way. We'll hit you in a devastating way. In other words, they're not going to dick around in Iraq doing that. They're going to do something else. And the move of the carrier battle group, you know, buttressed by those heavy bombers and stuff sends a clear message that's not going to be tolerated.
Yeah, that's not going to be a local target in Iraq,
right,
that might have, or Syria that might have Iranians there. I mean, and again, you know, what Iran has successfully done is to a certain extent what the United States has done, which is they're fighting a war not near their own country, right? And they're and they're killing other people. Now, the United States' position is we're fighting a defensive war, right, against these terrorists who would come to our country and kill innocent people as they did on September 11th. The Iranian, right, the Iranian response to that is, yeah, we're not fighting a defensive war. We're fighting a war to rid the region of outside influences and to extend our influence from Iran, right, very much like the Ottoman Empire, to the Mediterranean.
And yeah, they want to have what they call a Shia crescent, I guess, would be from Iran through Iraq into Syria and all the way to Lebanon. And because significant numbers of Shia live in all those places and are operating. I mean, so as you know, like when the 1983 Beirut bombing was run by, that was engineered by Iranians. As a matter of fact, you could say that the Hezbollah in Lebanon is nothing more than a unit of the Quds Force. You know, the Iranian the Iranian elite troops that they have there. So it's like, you're absolutely right. They're trying to extend influence. And the ultimate enemy, the little Satan, as they would say, is Israel. And the great Satan, of course, is us, yours truly, United States.
I want to play a little bit of audio for you, and then you can comment on that, and I'll let you go. This is General Dunford, and he's talking about an ongoing presence in Afghanistan. All right, and so you're going to hear the end of Secretary Shanahan's remarks, and then you're going to hear General Dunford begin to talk about Afghanistan. All right, and then I want to get your comments on it.
There is where we have presence is of greater value and importance to the Afghan people.
No. Sir, if I could address.
Can you hear that?
No.
Then that's not going to work.
Well, what do you say?
He essentially says that, look, the United States is going to have a continued presence, essentially in a denial mission of the region to Al-Qaeda and ISIL forces, and that is to protect the homeland of the United States, and that is not going to go away anytime soon.
Right.
Right, that we are certainly in support of. But he says, I can't see a way to a military victory in Afghanistan. It will be a negotiated settlement in Afghanistan, but we still have these enduring missions there that we have to be mindful of. So there will be an American presence there for the foreseeable future. That seemed to surprise some people. I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Well, when they say it's not going to be a military solution in Afghanistan, it's because large numbers of the population have just been kind of like given up to the Taliban, and then the Taliban actually, in some cases, has more to offer them than the government does. I mean, the drug trade is a huge source of finances now for the Taliban, whereas in the early days they were dead set against that type of thing. And so the idea that there'll always be, I think that if Afghanistan will go to its, I think what the general and the Defense Department is assuming is that Afghanistan will revert to what they've been many times throughout the last three centuries, and that there'll be a central government in the cities that basically is Afghanistan to the world, but the real, and they'll basically leave the hinterlands and the places on the border and so forth to the people who live there. And because the more they get involved with the people in the hinterlands, the more resentment there is. And there's conflict. There always is. And so in Afghanistan, he who governs least governs best. And so I think that they're looking that way. Now, as far as the United States, because of that environment in Afghanistan, it's a natural hiding place for bad guys. whether it be Osama bin Laden in the 90s and then into, you know, into early parts of the 2000s where he had to run away to Pakistan, to people throughout the ages. They hide out in Afghanistan the way criminals used to hide out in the territory of Oklahoma, because it's inaccessible in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so consequently, we're not going to let people come from that inaccessible place to work malfeasance on American interests either abroad or at home. I mean, those plans for 9/11 were fomented right there in southern Afghanistan. So I think that's what they're talking about. And that would be way more economical than the money pit it has become now. I mean, basically, they are pouring, we've been pouring billions into Afghanistan. Everything from how to teach these guys how to grow corn to, suffrage for women to, you name it. We're trying to make them not like the United States, because there's even conflict about some things in the United States about which way to go. We're trying to make these people the progressive paradise, you know? And that is not sustainable, either economically or, you know, by American citizens. So I think that's what they're basically talking about.
Right. Do you believe that there's a way to move them? I was talking to Gerald Alford. I don't know if you listened to that interview, but he comes from farm country in Georgia.
Yep.
And he believes there's a way to move them off of opium, but it's got to be incentivized. It's got to be subsidized, just like we would do in this country. And do you think that we can do that?
I mean, it has to be very disciplined, because
okay. And so there's a negotiated settlement, right? So the Taliban, right, it's part of the negotiation, has to get out of the opium business. Okay,
right.
so that would have to so the demand and the kind of the strong arm. For let's just say that some people don't want to grow opium, but they have to because the Taliban tells them to, or they're going to kill them, and that's not a theoretical assertion. So
right.
Let's just say that that demand and that coercion goes away. Do you see that as something that could happen there, or is it so entrenched in the world that you saw and so easy to grow, that it's going to be way more difficult than people think?
Well, here's what I think. The big problem in Afghanistan is when you give money, that's what we're talking about when we say resources. If you gave like Afghan representatives money, and this has been for hundreds of years, but particularly since the Russians got involved and then since we got involved, back starting in the 70s up to this day, the money you give doesn't go to the purpose it's intended because of the corruption. And that is their biggest problem in Afghanistan, is the individual corruption that's endemic throughout the government. And so that means the money's not getting there. Now, to fight that corruption, you put more of your own folks in there and you kind of shadow track. But that means you're in there then. You're in there then. And then if you start being effective against, and there isn't, the reason why people do dope isn't just because they're threatening to doing the dope business. It's very lucrative. It's very lucrative. Way more lucrative than growing pomegranates or anything else.
Right.
And they don't understand most of what the big deal is. Because they're not doing, most Afghans aren't using opium to make heroin and stuff like that. They don't see that. To them, it's like, if you don't like it, then don't do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
But there's a tremendous money draw for this thing. And I have to tell you, it's been exacerbated, especially in Helmand Province, since we got involved in this thing. Because now, one of the main vulnerabilities anybody who takes on the United States is not only are we good at combined arms and we're good at finding them, we have technology, we leverage that stuff, but we're also pretty good economically. So these guys have no way of making money. We can squeeze them off. We can put sanctions on people who want to give them, financial support and drive them into the opium trade. People who love opium gotta have opium. And people who, it's not just the opium addicts, it's the people who are addicted to the money they get. I mean, I don't care if you're in Mexico or you're in Colombia, you're in Turkey, and now if you're in Afghanistan, Pakistan, they love that money. Once the money's there, it's very hard to turn it off.
So you would categorize yourself as skeptical that we would ever be able to do that?
I hate to say it. I've been in Afghanistan a lot. I've been, and my jobs in Afghanistan have been working with Afghan government people, usually army. And most of them, are most of the guys I was advising, because the level I was advising were subject to people above who were corrupt.
But, but that is the way of the world. I mean, it's the United States. We have this kind of Pollyanna, right? We're an anomaly, I would say, in the world, and we're certainly an anomaly. The third world, or even the second and a half world, and most of the second world runs on, there's a reason I say this, and I use this example. There's a reason why people want to be in Customs and Border Patrol in Iraq.
Yeah.
Because you can get rich like that.
Sure.
And it's gone. It's been that way for hundreds of years since people started controlling borders. And so it is the system that is in place to do business, and it is all over the world. Go to the Philippines, right? And there's a system, call it bribes, call it patronage. If you want to do business, you got to go talk to this guy and the chief of police and the mayor, and everybody's in on it, or else it ain't happening.
Yes, you got to say, we always go, what was an example of helping somebody and it worked? So look through our history. Who did we help? Who do we help with aid and so forth, and it really paid dividends, and you could see an improvement. Okay, the first one would be Israel, from nothing, with very little help until the early 70s, really.
Right, right.
Did they get going? And then because they had proved they would do anything to hang on. They took Sherman tanks and refurbished them, using them up until the 1980s, the Super Sherman. The another good example is the South Koreans, but I'll tell you, it's hard to find it.
Right.
And the reason is what you just said. It's a worldwide problem. So when you give aid, unless you're giving this to somebody who really has a way of having a grip on his country, you're basically bribing this guy to not give you shit. You're not, like you say, I'm going to give you money so you can develop your farmland. Really, you're giving him money so he does what you want in some other area. Because even though it's ostensibly for, some higher purpose, the fact is you can't guarantee or even expect that the money you give to somebody for a specific purpose that's altruistic, education, agriculture, anything like that, you can't expect that that's going to get there without some kind of control. And the control usually means people. And people there breeds resentment. The more Americans who are overseas in a country, the more likely that there will be resentment. And that resentment, and the fact is it's a money, that in itself is a lot of money. So it's just a price you have to be willing to pay. Is Afghanistan worth that price? That's what we have to ask ourselves. Is it worth it?
And then one of the things that General Dunford said, look, he said, when I was there, we had over 100,000 troops in the country. He said, so by any standard, our effort there we've economized our effort. And that is absolutely true. He said, we're working on our footprint so that we can continue to support. And if you listen to General Alford talk about the way they do what they do, I mean, it's mostly training and an overwatch, and providing supportive arms. And knock on wood, the number of casualties has been few. But they still exist. And as Jeff said, is that in our national interest? And General Dunford will say it absolutely is, because if you see if you can look over the horizon, it's not hard to imagine what's going to happen here. Should we just unass and leave this place?
Yeah.
And then we're going to deal with it in another place. And then their contention is possibly the United States, because they're going to have, free movement, free training area, all the things that we've sought to deny them. So again, what is a win in Afghanistan? Is a win denying it? Because the only way in military operations to define winning is not to ticker tape parade down Main Street in Baghdad, right?
Right.
Right. So
you're right. I agree. I tell you, what we were talking about at the beginning of this thing, the idea that Iran is rattling their sabers, and we have intel that they're making moves that may manifest themselves in Iraq, where we have troops in a vulnerable position. So we basically demonstrate to them our willingness to strike them in areas not in the area that they strike.
Right.
To deny them assets they have now and cause them pain if they make moves that way. Well, perhaps the way of dealing with somebody, you know, who may launch an attack on you emanating from, you know, from the hinterlands of Afghanistan. If the government of Afghanistan doesn't have control over its inlands, it's senseless to prop up that government because they can't do anything about it anyway. But there are governments, like the ones who are responsible for supporting the guy who engineered 9-1-1, you can punish them, and we didn't. And I think those governments are like Pakistan. We acted like they're our allies.
Right.
They're our rankest enemy.
Right.
And the same thing with the individuals within the Saudi government and within the Saudi society were behind this thing. Almost all the hijackers were not, none of them were Afghans, you know, and a lot of them were either Saudis or Egyptians. Yet nothing was, you know, was propagated from those countries, on those countries. And those countries do have way better control over what goes on in theirs.
Not even us demanding that, look,
right.
U.S. nations have to renounce this suicide bombing shit when it happens.
Yeah.
Egypt,
right.
You know, you guys call yourself moderate Arab nations, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, right? The Arab League. You guys got to come out and say this is wrong. The killing of
right.
innocents in the name of this fucking jihad con job is bullshit. That is
yeah.
not what noble Islamic warriors do. They do not kill innocent women, children, and civilians. They don't do that. And so it's just, you know, but you don't even hear that.
No.
Anyway.
No, that, and I mean, President Bush actually said, you know, there's no way it could be the Saudis because the Crown Prince assured me it wasn't. He's
oh, there you go. There you go.
You know,
and again,
yeah.
dumber than a bag of hammers. All right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm proud of it.
All right. First of all, thanks for the discussion. I appreciate it.
Yep, and thanks for having me.
There you have it. The one and only Jeff Kenney, half of the Lunch Kenney Hour here on Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. We'll take a quick break. More of that great program coming up on your home for it. Next, the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it on Thursday. Thanks for listening. If you're just tuning in, today's program is a great program, honestly. I don't say that because I'm in it. I'm saying that because I listen to it. So don't touch that dial, whatever you do. In the first hour, you're going to hear General Dunford in his own words talking about everything from the movement, the intelligence over the weekend, the actions that they took. The movement of aircraft carriers and B-52 squadrons, and you're going to hear that in more detail than you've ever heard. You're going to hear him talk about North Korea. You're going to hear about our nuclear program. You're going to hear him talk about Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Afghanistan. He made headlines. What made headlines was his comment about Afghanistan, but he said that for a long time, and that is, right, we have a strategic fight there against the forces of Al-Qaeda and ISIL that is separate and apart from the government of Afghanistan's fight with the Taliban. And in order to maintain that fight and keep pressure on them and defend the United States, we fight that fight there. So he said that for a long time, but you'll hear that. And then you'll hear a really interesting discussion about discipline with somebody sent me an email last night, and it had three things that General Van Riper published as the CG of the 2nd Division. They were published on 11 July 1991, and so we talked about that, and we talked about the linkage between the experience that officers like General Van Riper had in Vietnam and their devotion to discipline and being better and what it was to be a Marine and how interesting it was to listen to them and some of the stuff that we heard from leaders who fought as advisors, leaders who fought as company commanders, who would come and speak while we were junior officers. So you'll hear that discussion as well. So whatever you do, trust me, don't touch that dial. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Wishing you a great day. We are over and out.